SodexoUSA.com.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You know, it seems so contradictory that the business of war, described by some as a form of organized killing sanctioned by the state, should be accompanied by something as beautiful as music. But in many ways, music reflects war in the way that the leaders of the day wanted people to see it, as a noble enterprise with lofty goals, worthy of blood sacrifice. At least that holds true for the official music America heard as its soldiers marched off to battle, from the Revolution all the way up to Vietnam. But the folk songs and later protest songs told a more sobering tale about the cruel costs of victory and the people's right to say no. Patriotism and protest, the A and B side of war music. Connection listeners, how does music help inspire or reflect the feelings of people in times of conflict? What does the music of war through the years tell us about changing attitudes toward battle? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined today by the noted musicologist Jerry Silverman. For more than 40 years, he studied the music of this country. He has written more than 200 books on music, among them Of the I Sing, Lyrics and Music for America's Most Patriotic Songs. And Jerry's joining us from the NPR studios in New York City. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning.
I gather you've brought your guitar along with you as well.
Yes, I did. I never travel anywhere without my guitar.
Should we?
We're attached to each other.
I wonder if we should mark the fact that where we want to start today, which is back in the first martial music of this country, the music of the Revolution, there's not a lot on compact disc and from that time. We rely on musicians like yourselves and others to take us back. Is that fair?
Well, that's fair, and the reason is that the songs from the Revolutionary War period are not really what you would call singable tunes in the current sense of the word. There are a few, the Yankee Doodles, that have come down to us, but many of them are kind of polemics which borrow heavily from the British tradition of pompous lyrics and imposing hymn-like melodies. But there are exceptions, of course.
There was a shift, though, at that time, from the sacred to the more inspirationally secular songs, was there not?
Well, nothing like a good old war to bring that out. What happens is, of course, that the common soldier sings about what's on his mind, the battles, the fear, the bravery, the homesickness. But he doesn't usually write them down because he's too busy doing soldiering things, and besides which, he generally is not capable of doing that. But we're lucky when somebody comes along who is also a soldier and a musician.
Let's talk about this fiddler from the 11th Pennsylvania Regiment.
Yes, well, I've been dying to tell this story on the air for many, many years. There was, believe it or not, Captain George Bush of the 11th Pennsylvania Regiment, who joined the Army in 1776 when he was a mere 23 years old. And by 1779, he had risen to the rank of captain. And he began to collect the songs, and he was really the man for the job because he was educated, and he played the fiddle, and he took the time to write things down as he heard them. Many of the songs that he heard had been published before. Some of them had been tunes that were familiar to everyone. Some of them had a British-sounding melody, as I mentioned. But the one that I'd like to bring to our listeners today is a rouser, in that sense of the word. It's called the drum, and it's a kind of an 18th century glorification of hell-raising and fighting and drinking and then kissing the girls and then going back off to make war again.
All right. So,
of course, for every martial song, there's, as you say, the B-side, which is the other view of it. So if I may, I'll sing a verse, just a quickie, to give you an idea of what the drum sounds like. Come each gallant lad who for pleasure quits care to the drum. To the drum, to the drum, head with spirit repair. And each young soldier with his lass. Hark the drum beats tattoo, hark the drum beats tattoo, reveling the sweet night to pass. And then he goes on to tell about drinking and killing and all those wonderful things. And that's about the size of it.
George Bush wrote this song, though.
George Bush. I don't know what his middle initial was. If it was W, it could have been for Washington, maybe. But otherwise, I really don't know.
Now, the songs about war were a number of different things. They were, I guess, ballads that told, ballads that told the story of significant events, right?
Yes. And those tended to be heroic. The gallant lads leading the charge against the enemy, in this case the Redcoats. But there was also the girl I left behind me, who, while she may have been proud, in quotation marks, to send her Johnny off to war, really had other feelings about it. One of the most poignant is called Johnny Has Gone for a Soldier. Now, in the grand tradition of borrowing well-known melodies and fitting new words to them, Johnny Has Gone for a Soldier is based on an Irish song, Shúil a Gra, which means Come With Me, My Love, which dates way back to the Treaty of Limerick, and as everybody knows, that was in 1691.
But what you're going to play for us is also from the time of the Revolutionary War.
Yes, this is a Revolutionary War version. In other words, they took the melody. What you do if you want your poem to be widely sung is to put it to the tune of a well-known song. And everybody would have known the Irish song, Come With Me, My Love. And what it was transformed into was Johnny Has Gone for a Soldier. Sit on a buttermilk hill. Who can blame me? Cry my fill, and every tear would turn a mill. Johnny has gone for a soldier. Me, oh my, I loved him so. Broke my heart to see him go, and only time will heal my woe. Johnny has gone for a soldier. And then in the grand tradition of the girlfriend dressing up as a boy or as a man to follow her beloved to the battlefield. I'll dye my dress, I'll dye it red, and through the streets I'll beg for bread, for the lad I love from me has fled. Johnny has gone for a soldier.
I could be mistaken, but I think I heard you singing that with Peter, Paul, and Mary at some point.
Well,
popularized
they sang
in the 60s, wasn't it?
Well, they sang it by themselves. I was listening that time.
I want to move ahead, if I can, to the Civil War and a look at the song Battle Cry of Freedom, because
okay.
What strikes me about this one is we were talking about it in the office yesterday, and someone said, oh, yeah, well, that was a song from the North. And someone said, no, it's a song from the South. And maybe you can explain that dichotomy.
Well, okay, first of all, right, let me tell you who wrote the song, because that's an interesting story in itself. His name was George Frederick Root, and he wrote dozens and dozens of well-known songs. Battle Cry of Freedom was his hit tune. It sold hundreds of thousands of copies long before there was any mechanical way of reproducing music or getting people to buy it because they heard it on the radio or the jukebox. He studied music in Europe, and he was such an admirer of the European classical tradition that he changed his name from George W. Root. He wrote his first names under the name G.W. Wurzel. Wurzel, of course, means root in German, and G.W. might have been interpreted as Handel's first initials. George Frederick Root. I'm thinking of G.W. Bush. So he called himself G.W. Wurzel, but he wrote his Civil War songs under the name of Root. He wrote a lot of oratorios which died aborning under the name of Wurzel.
But would he have written a Union version and a Dixie version?
No. What happened was, just as I said about parodies and songs being written to other people's tunes. He wrote his battle cry of freedom, and it was as if the Confederates were lying in wait for it, but no sooner did the song get written than a Southern battle cry was put forth. But practically every Union song became a Southern song, and many Southern songs became Union songs.
All right, forgive us, North Carolina. We're going to listen to the Union version of the Battle Cry of Freedom, at least a little bit of it here.
Oh, we'll rally round the flag, boys, we'll rally once again, shouting the battle cry of freedom. And we'll rally from the hillside, we'll gather from the plain, shouting the battle cry of freedom. The Union forever, hurrah, boys, hurrah, down with the traitor.
And of course, Jerry, that's the part at which the Southern version becomes our Dixie forever, she's never at a loss.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This kind of trade-off happened lots. I remember the you know, reading that the American soldiers took Yankee Doodle and turned it into something that they would sing back to the British who'd originally intended it as something that was supposed to make fun of them. But I wonder if I can get you, before we go to our break, to speak briefly about the song Marching Through Georgia, because there's one, if we look back to the Civil War, where... Gosh, you play that song in some parlors in this country and everybody will leave the room still.
Right. It was written by Henry Clay Work, whose other great hit song was the sentimental tune My Grandfather's Clock. But he wrote Marching Through Georgia shortly after General Sherman began his famous march through the sea in November 64. And it became so popular that General Sherman began to listen to it with, as was written somewhere, supreme disgust. It pursued him from city to city, from state to state, and wherever he toured Europe, he was received with Marching Through Georgia. He had enough of it. But of course, the song really was a terrific song. Shall we listen to it?
Yeah, a little bit of Marching Through Georgia. This is an instrumental version, so what you're not hearing is the We Bring the Jubilee, the flag that makes you free, speaking about one flag and another group of people. A little bit here of Marching Through Georgia. Jerry, we have to take a break in a couple of minutes, but before we do that, when you look at that period of the Revolution and the Civil War, these were songs largely meant to inspire, weren't they?
Oh, yes. That was their purpose. And none was more inspirational than the song with which you opened the program, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which the composer, Patrick Gilmore, after the war, organized monster peace jubilee concerts with orchestras of 1,000 and choruses of hundreds and anvils and cannons. He out 1812, the 1812 overture.
All right, Connection listeners, when we come back after the break, we're going to make a shift to the music of the World Wars, World War I and World War II, and the introduction of a little bit more dissent in the music, or at least a sardonic wry twist to it. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, and we'd like you to join us in our conversation about the way music traces the arc of politics and war and battle. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WB2.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR, and we're listening to the music of wartime. Phone number is 1-800-423-8255. Joining us from the NPR studios of New York City is Jerry Silverman, the noted musicologist, author of too many books on music. You couldn't even carry them on a bicycle with six backpacks and racks. 1-800-423-8255 to join us. Jerry, this is the Army, Mr. Jones.
Yes, it is.
And a song which, in a way, introduces, I guess, a certain element of humanity into the music of war, which wasn't present in the earlier century, was it?
Well, by the time World War I rolled around, Tin Pan Alley was in full blast. And the songs that they cranked out of Tin Pan Alley were kind of fantasies. They were raggy tunes and jazzy tunes and funny tunes with titles like Mother Sitting Knitting Little Mittens for the Navy. Of course, they were...
George Cohen was a Tin Pan Alley author, was
right.
He not? The Yankee Doodle
indeed.
Boy. And wasn't that the origin of Over There as well?
That's correct, yes. That was, of course, the big hit song, like the Battle Cry Freedom for the Civil War. That was the tremendous hit song of World War I. But there were some subdued protest songs as well, which didn't get to be heard too much. And there were also songs that the doughboys, particularly the black soldiers, sang in France because they were subject to discrimination and Jim Crow even within their own ranks. But there's one beauty of a protest song. Not exactly a protest. Maybe that's too strong a word. But there's a song called I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier. And this is the mother singing about her son going off to war. I'll just sing a little bit of the chorus. I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. I brought him up to be my pride and joy. Who dares to place a musket on his shoulder to shoot some other mother's darling boy? Let nations arbitrate their future troubles. It's time to lay the sword and gun away. There'd be no war today if mothers would all say, I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier.
I wonder whether or not you see that, Jerry, as the beginning, the origins of protest war music in this country, or was it aimed specifically at the politicians, or just a kind of feeling that war wasn't really a very good thing?
Well, there was always an undercurrent, certainly in the families of the boys who marched off, that it was not such a good thing. But now we have mass distribution. We have the beginning of records and radios coming through, and these songs got to be heard perhaps more than they would have under other circumstances when there was no way to publicize them.
I want to go back to Cohen's Over There because mm-hmm. our engineer, Doug, has found a terrific Caruso version of it, and we can't pass by without listening to a little bit. Doug, can we hear that? Well, the boys are coming, and so are the calls. We're talking about war music, listening to a little bit of it. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. And we're going to Jessica now, who's called in from Boston. Hi, Jessica.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Great. I was calling in because you're talking about the music as a form of marking a period and recounting history. What about music as a psychological tool, whether it be as a relaxing tool for the soldiers or a psych tool to the enemy, as in the Scottish Pipes?
Jerry, what can you tell us about that? I mean, what was the thinking behind the music, also to psych out the enemy as well as to inspire your own troops?
Well, first of all, Over There, which we just heard, certainly was the inspirational song of the period. Then, as far as psyching out the enemy, there's a very amusing song, Keep Your Head Down, Fritzy Boy, which was written by a Canadian named Gitz Rice, who was taunting the Germans by saying, if you want to see your father in the fatherland, keep your head down, Fritzy boy. So there was that kind of thing, too. But I don't know if the Germans ever heard it.
Well,
that
Spike
was really
Jones
for,
did a lot of this, Der Führer's face and,
right,
and
exactly.
stuff like
but,
that.
You know, but that didn't have any effect on the Führer, I'm sure.
I wonder, Jessica, where we would plot a song like Lili Marlene, which was popular not only with the Germans but with the Allies in the First World War, a song which in many ways is referred to as music of the war, but that spanned both sides. What do you think, Jessica? Are you there? Oh, we've lost our
Jessica's
call.
Not there. Well,
that's
I can
okay,
answer
Jerry.
That
yeah, you
in
take
a bit.
That one on.
Well, Lili Marlene, which was first composed in German, was a kind of a sentimental song, not specific to any war. It was the girlfriend waiting outside the barracks for her boyfriend. And it got translated into practically every language. I mean, English, we know the English version. There were French versions, Russian versions. There was an underground anti-fascist version about waiting online for rationed meat when the meat store only has bones. It caught on. It served everybody's purpose. But that's exactly what I was saying. You take a familiar tune and you put your words to it and you're guaranteed an audience. Somewhere someone will know it and hum along with you.
This is a little bit of Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition. Now, help me with this one, Jerry. Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition doesn't have that same sort of it's a long way to Tipperary, you know, let's all sing this together ring about it. Would this be one that we'd look at that was intended to try and ennoble the Second World War when that came out?
Well, the story behind that song actually is, in fact, there was a chaplain at Pearl Harbor who was, his name was Chaplain, his last name was Forgy, F-O-R-G-Y.
Huh.
Who was heard saying to the gunners, in fact, praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. The phrase obviously caught on, and it was left to Frank Lesser, the great Broadway composer, to put it into a song form. But it really had an inspirational intent at first.
Let's bring in Richard now, who's called in from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Hi, Richard.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
I'm a teacher, a high school history teacher. I often use music in teaching, and it can be a nice, it serves as a really vivid way of recapturing some of the texture and the changes over time that happen. When I was listening to you talk about the Civil War, one of the things that I've noted in using music with my students is that all of the big marching songs, or a lot of them, Battle Hymn of the Republic, Battle Cry of Freedom, come from early in the war. But it's interesting, if you watch the music down toward the latter part of the war, 1863, 64, 65, songs like Tenting on the Old Campground and The Vacant Chair come out later. And these are songs about the weariness of war and about the death and the bloodiness of it, so that you can sort of gauge, to some degree anyway.
How far ahead can you go with this, Richard? I mean, do you take it through the turn of the century and into the World War period
teaching? I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier with
right.
World War I. Actually, one of the more interesting ones, because students come in with certain ideas about the Vietnam War that everyone protested and everyone was against it, which, of course, begs the question of, okay, then why didn't we just pull out? Somebody had to be, and one of the great forgotten songs of the period, although it's not that great a song as songs go, is the Ballad of the Green Berets, which by all kinds of measures was the single biggest selling song about the Vietnam War, and it's, you know, a pro-soldier, pro, to some degree, pro-war song.
Fighting soldiers from the sky, fearless men who jump and die, men who mean just what they say, the brave men of the Green Beret.
So, Richard, how about calling that one?
Not bad.
Yeah, we've got pretty good engineers here.
You're on top of it.
But it's interesting, Jerry, because as Richard rightly points out, you say Vietnam to most people today, and it's floppy hats and acoustic guitars and protest songs that are much more familiar than one like that.
Well, it's true. What it really boils down to is that in any generation, not necessarily even about war. It's the songs from the underside of society which have the most to say and last the longest. Satisfied people don't write songs about how wonderful life is, other than, of course, the Never Never Land of Tin Pan Alley and Broadway. But all the Woody Guthrie Dust Bowl ballads and all the songs about civil rights, the civil rights movement, these are the protest songs which really reflect society in its basic emotions. And those are the ones which not only deserve to live, but have lived.
All right, Richard, thanks a lot for your call. I know that when we move into wartime periods, like the years of the First and the Second World War and Vietnam, then we're also moving into, Jerry, a class of songs that aren't written specifically about or for or to the soldiers, but are meant to try and capture a mood or a feeling that would have been prevalent at that time. One example that I like is the Frank Sinatra version of I'll Be Seeing You.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart and mind embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut trees, the wishing well.
Just you listen to the images that he's evoking there, Jerry, of the chestnut tree and all those things that are meant to be so warm and familiar. In wartime, of course, they become much more poignant images.
Yes, and that's... that goes back a long way. I mean, for example, the Civil War was full of these poignant images of the empty chair, mother's old red shawl, who will care for mother now?
Where did Heart of Oak come from? That's a little bit of both. That's the strength of the soldier and the oak tree at the same time.
Well, Heart of Oak is an old, I think it's a Welsh song going way, way back.
So and when... sorry, go ahead, Jerry.
Then it was, its imagery then was transferred to the Revolutionary War period.
There was an interesting thing also that happened with both these wars, that the music of the United States, the wartime music of the United States, was in many ways playing off the music that came from Britain. I mean, if you think about Vera Lynn and the White Cliffs of Dover and the music that she had so marked as part of the Second World War, those then became tunes that were popular and performed in the United States by leading artists of the time here, like Kay Kaiser and others.
Well, we could relate to those songs because the musical idiom was so familiar to Americans. Of course, the language was there and the style of performing. I mean, we don't remember too many Norwegian songs from the war. I'm sure there were, but they just didn't resonate in this country. But people sang all over the world during all the wars, and we know the ones in English because that's where we are, but it's not exclusively an American phenomenon by any means.
There's a one that we were thinking of playing called On a Wing and a Prayer. Is that one that fits the mold, which is both
Absolutely.
A little bit British and American?
Yes. Well, it's an American song, but I mean, it certainly was sung. The RAF boys, I'm sure, sang it as well, coming in a wing and a prayer.
Let's hear it, Doug.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer. We coming in on a wing and a prayer. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Though there's one motor gone, we can still carry on. We coming in on a wing and a prayer.
You know what's going to happen, Jerry? There's going to be people all over this country humming that song or whistling one that we played earlier in the program, because there's something really distinctive about the music that is attached to the wartime period, where it's quite memorable. It strikes a chord that's a little bit deeper than some other songs.
And certainly that arrangement, that gospel arrangement. Who's singing it, by the way? Do we know the performers on that one?
That's the Ink Spots.
Ink Spots. It's a beautiful arrangement.
But I mean, do you think that holds both on the protest side as well as on the songs that are more flattering of the soldiers and war, that there's something about those songs that sticks?
Well, first of all, a song has to be judged, among other things, on its merits as a song.
Right.
It has to be a good song. It has to be musically interesting, lyrically interesting. And then, of course, if it's a controversial issue, whether it's on one side or another, whoever is for it will remember it, and whoever is against it will not remember it or will not want to sing it. But really, it has to be a good song. A polemic set to music doesn't live very long. That was the problem, for example, with many of the songs of the Revolutionary War. They said all the right things, but it sounded like you were listening to a Handel oratorio rather than a song.
And so what is it about the songs written 60 years ago that still work today? What had they got right?
It's simplicity. You have to really say it in the popular idiom, and that goes for music as well as lyrics. And it has to be an attractively performed performance as well. Otherwise, it's just a boring statement. You could just as soon see it on a placard carried on a picket line somewhere.
Okay, I know what I'm whistling for the rest of the day. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And we are talking and listening to the music of wartime. When we come back after the break, a little bit of a shift into the Vietnam time and the flood of protest music that marked that particular era. And we'll try and take a bit of a longer view about what it is that music says, not only just about a particular period, but about a nation. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
It was back in 1942. I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
Pete Seeger, 1967, waist-deep in the big muddy, and we're talking this hour about the songs of wartime. There certainly was quite a dramatic shift to popular music and the popularization of protest songs. Jerry Silverman's with me on the program. Jerry's a musicologist joining us from New York. And I guess, Jerry, in many ways, the Vietnam provides something of a catalyst for all the different areas that protest music was coming from.
Well, The Big Muddy, which Pete actually wrote in 1963, was published for the first time, I believe, in Sing Out magazine, it's a folk song magazine, in January 67. And on the page, I'm looking at it right now, on the page in which The Big Muddy appears are some quotes from Mark Twain, which I think are so appropriate, were appropriate then and are just as appropriate today. I'll just read you a sentence or two. He writes, "Our country, right or wrong, an empty phrase, a silly phrase. It was shouted by every newspaper. It was thundered from the pulpit. The superintendent of public instruction placarded it in every schoolhouse in the land. The War Department inscribed it upon the flag. And every man who failed to shout it or who was silent was proclaimed a traitor." And then he goes on to say, "We cannot retire from it without dishonor. Why, not even a burglar could have said it better. We cannot withdraw from this sordid raid because to grant peace to those little people upon their terms, independence, would dishonor us."
The interesting thing about this song is that Seeger starts in 1942, but he ends up talking about LBJ.
"Well, I'm not going to point any moral. I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
It's almost hard, Jerry Silverman, to think back to the mid-60s and just how controversial it would have been for a singer to stand on a stage and refer, if only in oblique terms, to the president of the country as the big fool. And that's what Seeger was doing.
Yes, he did. And I think we have a great deal to thank him for on that. Not specifically that song, but his whole attitude about war and protest and peace and all those other good things that we good folks, I think we are anyhow, are fighting for.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Cary, North Carolina. George is with us. Hi, George.
Hi. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling in.
Okay. Would you like me to...
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. In any case, what I was saying was that I think that music, of course, entirely evokes memories, as does poetry and things, you know, some of the artsy stuff. But I think especially warring songs are, you know, getting deeply embedded into your mind that, you know, I was saying that even though when I was a little boy, I was forced to march for the fascists, and there were war songs, fascist songs that we really got to hate, fascism and the songs. But yet now I'm about 70 years old, and from time to time I hum some of the songs that I really despised and they were attached to very, very bad memories.
Give me an example of one of the ones, if you can, George. Hum something for us.
One is called Giovinezza, which means it relates to young folks. And it goes, Giovinezza, Giovinezza, la più bella della... So it's a song that evokes your... to go to fight, against the Allies at that time. But I cannot understand why from time to time I hum it, even though... we have learned to despise fascism with all our heart and soul at that time.
Just going to ask Jerry for some advice here, George, how it is that a song that's giving out all the wrong messages.
Well, I'll tell you why, because Giovinezza has actually a very catchy tune. If you abstract the words from it, or even if you say Giovinezza, which means youth, if you just blank out on the hidden meaning behind it, it is a catchy tune, and why not remember it? Maybe it would have been good to have written some other sets of words to it, as we've seen through the years. I'm sure there were. I'm sure the Italian partisans wrote other words to it, because I know some Italian partisan songs which took familiar, for example, Red Army songs, and put them into an Italian context. So that happens all over the world. Good songs, good tunes live on, despite their lyrics sometimes.
George, thanks a lot for your call. And thanks for singing for us. 1-800-423-8255 to Chapel Hill, North Carolina now, and Don's with us. Hi, Don.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine, thanks.
I appreciate this program. I'm enjoying it. I don't think I've ever heard the Big Muddy before. Let me tell you this. I'm a veteran from the Vietnam era, and I was flying out of Thailand in 68, and we flew predominantly in the evening. And when we came in back to the base, we would crank up the jukebox at the bar, and one of the songs I always remember, a very catchy tune, but it got us into the mood of the period, was those a Dusty Springfield song, I believe, Those Were the Days. And every time I hear that, I, of course, brings back memories. But it was a way of almost a catharsis to help us get through the previous day's activities.
And so the war music of your war is not or wasn't actually anything that was written about or for the war, but it was a way of kind of clearing that stuff out of your head.
Well, that's one thing. Also, it was a tune that we could all sing to, and there were several discordant voices singing together there. I mean, it was interesting to see colonels and lieutenants up to the bar singing along with that song, because I think you would think of Dusty Springfield as an anti-war song or something like that, or singer. Anyway, but one other item just to mention to you, and I'll get out of your hair here. One of the things that always brings back memories is the theme song from Platoon, George Barber's Adagio for Strings. And, I, you know, that was never meant to be a war song. But, boy, I tell you, anytime I hear that, it stops me, and I think about what happened those years.
I actually have much the same reaction to that same piece of music, and of course wasn't in Vietnam, but it's a great example, Don, of just how a piece of music can be attached to an event even after the fact. So thanks for your observations from over there.
Okay.
Interesting to hear that.
Well, come on, all of you big strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. Got himself in a terrible jam way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books and pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why.
Jerry, are you playing along with Country Joe and the Fix?
Yes, I am. Well, we're not quite in tune, but I tried anyhow.
This is The Fixin' to Die Rag by Country Joe McDonald. And you know, one of those classic Woodstock-style era, you know, get up and sing along with the artist. That was the point of this type of song, wasn't it?
Well, he writes that he wrote it in April 1967, and he frankly says he was stoned out of his mind as he was writing it, something like David Wells and his take on the Yankees, I suppose. And he was just overwhelmed by people supporting the war and people against the war. He was at a big anti-war rally, and there were people booing him and there were people cheering him. And somehow, in his altered state, shall we say, this Fixin' to Die Rag was born. That's another way songs get written, just kind of as a burst of inspiration at the moment.
Listen, people, I don't know how you expect to ever stop the war if you can't sing any better than that. There's about 300
right.
Look, at least he could count, you know? I mean, that's got to stand for,
absolutely,
for something. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana now, and John's joining us. Hi, John.
How y'all doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling in.
No, thank you. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
That last tune y'all played was, I've never heard it. I'm a pretty young guy, and all that Vietnam stuff from before and this and that, I really have not been able to experience what it was like to go through those wars and that music. I've only known, you know, up to recent times. And really, for that matter, the music from the Revolutionary Wars and Civil Wars and all that stuff from before, because that's what's been put to me, okay? I guess my main question, though, so I can get out the way, is with our time period being the way it is, wars and, you know, possible and all this stuff, people, it seems like to me, a lot of artists are trying to make money off of the war. I guess my main question to you, Jerry, is do you feel that the great war tunes from the past and the great symphonies and all these interesting songs that were inspired by war, do you feel that time period is gone, or do you feel that we just lost touch with what war is and why we write those songs? And I'll let you answer.
Well, songs are still being written. They're always being written. There are songs being written today about the Iraq situation. We have to step back, though, and see if they'll survive the test of time. As I say, writing a polemic, just a bunch of slogans and stringing them together, doesn't necessarily make a good song. It has to live beyond its time. The songs that are so specific to any one moment very often don't stand the test of time.
Let's check one now. We have actually a song by Darrell Worley, which is up on the country charts, called Have You Forgotten?
They say we don't realize the mess we're getting in. Before you start your preaching, let me ask you this, my friend. Have you forgotten how it felt that day to see your homeland under fire and her people blown away? Have you forgotten when those towers fell? We had neighbors still inside, going through a living hell. And you say we shouldn't worry, have you forgotten?
All right, John in Baton Rouge. Does that fit your category of a song that may be a commercial exploitation of war?
If I hadn't heard that song, I probably wouldn't be calling your show today. That song just completely, it really made me mad. And I've seen videos, music videos, showing images of our troops out there. And I get mad. I get mad. Why are they doing this? It's not what... Back from these songs from the revolutionary time and the gospel hymn we heard earlier in your show, and for that matter, the one from 67, which it was even funny, those were tunes that seemed like they were truly inspired for the sake of being heard by a people that are facing these times. This Worley guy and a couple other people I've heard, actually, they write these songs, and they make glamorous videos, and go in different shows.
Let me turn quickly, John, thanks for your call, turn quickly to Jerry Silverman for a sense of, Jerry, can we even know today whether or not a song like that will be listened to 5 years or 50 years from now?
No, we obviously can't know it, but I would probably bet that it wouldn't be. Not that that's not a good song for the moment, but from my perspective, it doesn't have the true ring of what might one day become a folk song. It's a good song. I mean, rhyming "forgotten" with Bin Laden is a rhyme. It's a kind of a stretch.
It's a novel,
and he's telling a story.
But I guess what I need is one quick last snapshot from you, because you look at this from the context of songs written at the time of the revolution, and do you feel that music still is attached to war in the way that it was back then? Is it still used the same way to touch our emotions?
I don't think so. I mean, yes, there's a lot of stuff being written, but I think it's too soon to judge our generation and our time. But if history teaches us anything, there's nothing new under the sun. And as long as there are problems, whether they be monumental ones like war and peace, or homegrown social problems, which are also with us all the time, there will be songwriters, and the songs will get born and live.
Jerry, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're certainly welcome.
Jerry Silverman, musicologist specializing in American folk music. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is